Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, this is a call-in show, and our topic today is understanding the basic principles of freedom. So please call us with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. Let me repeat that for you. That's 1-800-313-9443. Folks, today we are continuing our conversation with Dr. Paul Cleveland from our February 13th, 2010 show, which you will find for free download on our archives at www.radiofreemarket.com. But first, I would like to say hello to our special commentator, Miss Zoe Russell. Hello, Zoe.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Good. So next, I would like to welcome our special guest this week, Dr. Paul Cleveland. Hello, Paul.
Hello. How you doing, Michael?
Excellent. Thank you very much for being with us today. So, folks, let me remind you that Dr. Cleveland is a professor of economics at Birmingham Southern College in Birmingham, Alabama, and has written an excellent book called Unmasking the Sacred Lies, which gives a terrific historical understanding of how America has arrived here in its current condition. It covers the whole of U.S. economic history in a way that sticks to the facts and tells a story that hardly anyone hears. You know, I highly recommend this book for anyone who's interested in a solid education in economic history. I found this book absolutely eye-opening. Folks, I'd love for all of you to read this excellent book, which, by the way, we are featuring on our website at radiofreemarket.com. But since we, again, cannot read the whole book on the show with you today, Paul, we're going to start with the end of your book, Unmasking the Sacred Lies. And let me ask you this. Just what are the biggest sacred lies that you're talking about in your book?
Well, I think the biggest lie is one that Frederick Bastiat pointed out in the 19th century. And he said that the greatest fiction there is the fiction that the state is capable of providing for us. And so the state becomes this big fiction where everyone attempts to live at everyone else's expense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we're all trying to participate in the political system to vote benefits our way, well, the government can't just give us anything that they didn't first take from somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're trying to play that game, what we're really doing is we're wasting our scarce resources trying to pick each other's pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And Bastiat referred to it as legalized plunder. Mm-hmm. And truly, I think every other lie that we have in different policy areas can be traced back to this one.
And for those listeners who haven't yet read the excellent book by Bastiat, mm-hmm. The Law, I would recommend it very highly. You can find it on a number of websites for free viewing, Mises.org, that's Mises.org, and fee.org, that's for the Foundation of Economic Education, at fee.org. You know, I like the way you laid this out in your book, Paul, because you mentioned, and I'm going to steal a little of your thunder here, three things that really encompass the biggest sacred lie, which is government is capable of addressing all human problems, providing superior solutions to those problems, and successfully plan and manage the economy. Can you outline that a little bit more?
Sure. You know, the whole notion that government planning can work is really a fallacy. The truth is that the way economies work is that prices, market prices, are very important. Because they help us coordinate our activities with one another in important ways. And
you know, Paul, I'm going to have to interrupt you. I'm sorry, because
okay.
We are coming up to a break right now. And so, everyone, please stick with us. We're going to pick this thread up right after the break. So this is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and I have with me Dr. Paul Cleveland, and we're going to be talking about today understanding the basic principles of freedom. So, Paul, we were just talking about the biggest sacred lies, the lies that are basically told and accepted by everyone that really kind of screw things up. You were outlining these as that government is capable of addressing human problems, all human problems. They can provide superior education, retirement funds, and health care, and it really even has the wherewithal to successfully plan and manage the economy. So please go into that a little bit more, if you would.
Sure. What I was saying is that prices serve a really important function in helping us to make our plans. And all people have their own ends, their own desires. And so really value, the very concept of value in the economy is an idea that is subjective. It's mm-hmm. subject to the person who's purposing an end. And so what market prices do is they allow us to achieve our ends through trading with others in ways that allow us to more effectively accomplish our ends. Now, when the government steps in and tries to plan this, they destroy all the market prices, and they destroy then the ability to see and to coordinate what is going on. So it's really a foolish sort of thing to do this, and it's a, if you will, kind of the height of arrogance among politicians to pretend that they know better than individual people. And so really, rather than achieving better ends, the ends end up being worse. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but then they monopolize markets like education. And once they've monopolized it, then people have no choice but to deal with the government. And so without a profit motive, there's no incentive to serve the interest of the consumer.
Mm-hmm. I want to insert here a quip from Groucho Marx, who said that politics is the art of looking for trouble, finding it, misdiagnosing it, and then applying the wrong remedies.
That's pretty good. That's exactly right.
And, so how did this process of embracing these sacred lies that government was capable of addressing human problems, providing superior solutions, and successfully planning, how did this come about?
Well, you know, the history of it is sort of unique. The founders of our country really articulated sound ideas and ideals and tried to build our country and the government on these sound ideals, which were all natural law-based, that all individuals possess as natural rights the right to their life, liberty, and property. And that what the purpose of government is merely a limited purpose of protecting those rights and that alone. While they stated that well, we never always practiced it.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Alexander Hamilton was a bit of a throwback to the days of mercantilism. And he advocated.
Could you explain what that word means, mercantilism?
Yeah, mercantilism was the political economic system that developed in Europe as the nation states began to be built. And the way that mercantilism worked was everything was centered around promoting the wealth of the king or the monarch. Mm-hmm. And so the king controlled the trade and then offered monopoly privileges to his favored few business interests. Of course, they had to pay the price to him.
So in one sense, I'm going to interrupt you here. So in one sense, the way in which this whole idea of these sacred lies became institutionalized in our culture is that, number one, it was promoted by some people who materially benefited from it.
Right. And so what Hamilton was doing is arguing for that continuation of this sort of favoritism for certain business interests through governmental means. And now he was not very successful, and he was opposed heavily by individuals like Thomas Jefferson and then later Andrew Jackson opposed some of the same ideas. And so the protectionist sorts of tariffs that he advocated, those were more or less held at bay until the election of Lincoln mm-hmm. in 1860. And when we have Lincoln elected, we have the introduction of all sorts of policies that the Republicans passed, because the Republicans of the time were the sort of the political heirs of Hamilton.
Okay.
And so they began the process of, you know, political favors to certain business interests. For example, the Morrill Tariff Act rapidly increased tariff rates in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
And I think the average tariff rate was the first of the ones that was passed in 1862 was like 37%.
Wow.
And then followed with another tariff act in 1864 that where the average tariff rate, I think, was around 45 to 47%, somewhere in that range.
So, I want to come back to this history outline, but I want to lay these tracks down a little bit more before we go there. We were just talking about the process of embracing the sacred lies, and you brought some principles that I thought were important for us to just lay down before we delve into your book. And, folks, I want to just tell you what was interesting about preparing for this particular show is that most shows have I work with a particular outline of information that's pretty much easy to follow and so on. What's unique about this book that I'm going to keep recommending to you, Unmasking the Sacred Lies, is that Paul outlines principles, he outlines history, and he does so very beautifully. And I think what I would like to establish here at Radio Free Market is we want people to understand the history and the context of these principles. And so you were saying that you know, one of the things that caused this process of embracing the sacred lies was that it was promoted by some people that benefited from it, like the mercantilist mentality. But for the public, they didn't embrace it for that reason. They embraced it actually because of a misguided kind of not being able to see the detrimental effects, or just being too busy for living. Would you comment more on that?
Sure. A couple of things there, I think. First, you know, in economics we have this idea of rational ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds kind of like an oxymoron to say it that way, but most people are busy, like you said, busy living their lives and are not particularly paying any interest in the political scene. And it's understandable, it's reasonable for people to do that because, on the one hand, their one vote is not likely to determine the outcome of any particular election.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, the cost of information are extremely high, so trying mm-hmm. to find out information about things is pretty high. And so as a result, people just don't know what their elected officials are doing. All right, that opens the door. If you know, if redistribution of public funds is allowed, then that opens the door for politicians to play these sorts of games and to play political favorites.
And I want to point out that you mentioned a third principle that actually caused this embracing of the sacred lies as being the rather false rhetoric and outright manipulation of information.
Right, right. And in fact, most of the legislative acts that the government passes, the names they give those pieces of legislation often have almost the opposite to do with what the legislation's really about.
Right, like the Patriot Act.
Right. If there were truth in advertising, most of our politicians would be in jail and would have been in jail long ago by now, because,
yeah.
Or at least would have been fined for false advertising in terms of the kinds of things they've passed. For example, campaign finance reform. Well, if they were accurately labeled, we would call them Re-Election Insurance Act. And that's because that's more or less their intent, you know, is to help the incumbents be reelected time in and time out.
That's right. Well, in this particular vein, I would like to recommend another website to everyone, and that would be shadowstats.com. That's shadowstats, STATS.com. And there's a lot of good free information there on how the history, recent history over the last few decades of how government reports have been manipulated in terms of the data that has been presented. And this is a subscription site, and you can, and I believe anyone who is very interested in this topic should subscribe to it. And you'll find out that, in fact, we have much higher unemployment than is presented by the federal government, a la around 21%. When you apply the accounting methodologies that were existing, for example, back in the 1960s. And so I recommend this shadowstats.com to unconfuse you about this manipulation of information. So, okay, let's use this information as a backdrop and pick up where we left off in February. This week what I'd like to do is start off with another break here. When we come back, folks, we're going to talk with Paul Cleveland Moore on this incredibly important topic of unmasking the sacred lies and understanding the basic principles of freedom. So please stay with us. This is Michael McKay and Radio Free Market, and we'll be back right after the break. All right. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking with Dr. Paul Cleveland on understanding the basic principles of freedom. So let's start with the real basics, coming from the monumental work of Ludwig von Mises, who wrote the book Human Action. Humans act. What more does this teach us, Paul?
Well, I really think it's important to, you know, to begin economics here. And I really appreciate Mises' work so much for this, because the reality is that we're creatures who we're self-aware. We think about ourselves. We think about the future. We can think about a better situation for ourselves. We can make our plans of how we want to get there, and then we can implement those plans by acting on them. There's a very distinct process there of what we do, and there are a number of features to that. First, we never engage in any kind of action that we don't think will achieve our end. And so incentives make a huge difference. If I don't think an action is going to achieve the end, I just don't do it. Now, what happens when the government comes in and tries to thwart people's actions or hampers them, oftentimes people just give up. And that was really the case in the Soviet Union. You know, they had jokes at the time, well, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us.
Right.
it doesn't work. It just won't work. And, you know, so that's important. The other thing that's important is there's no such thing as the collective. There's no such thing as ontological existence to society.
But because only individuals act.
Because only individuals act. Now, we can act in association with one another towards a common goal or a common purpose, and we do that quite frequently.
And we choose to act together.
Right. We're choosing to act together for a bigger goal. And you know, that's quite understandable, and that's are important things to do, but it's still, if I want to understand the action, I have to go down to the individual level.
I heard a lecture by Murray Rothbard where he said that that would be the difference between Austrian economics or reality economics and all other schools of thought, especially the government, that the Austrian economists work from the individual level, and every other group tries to divide into aggregates and classes.
That I think that's really true. And all of this began with really with the introduction of utilitarianism into economics. Of course, that dates back to the 19th century and the work of Jeremy Bentham. And what Bentham tried to argue is that we ought to choose public policies on the basis of a hedonistic calculus to make to get the greatest happiness or the greatest pleasure for the greatest number of people. And really, it's this utilitarianism, this sort of legal positivism, that has driven a lot of the policies in America, and people almost acquiesce to it by default. But it really, it can't be done because you can't measure utility. I mean, what is a util? I have no clue what a util is. I mean, I know what an inch is. I know what a mile is. I know what a gallon is or a liter. But what is a util? And if we can't measure it, then how do we accomplish Bentham's end? You know, it can't be done. You know, when Bill Clinton was in was president and serving in the Oval Office, he told us that he could feel our pain. Well, I know he felt all sorts of things while he was there, but that our pain was one of them. You know?
Okay.
Anyway, these sorts of things can't be done. And we're playing a game that's unwinnable. It's sort of like choosing public policy by trying to decide which child's going to be happier to get an ice cream cone. You know, we'll allow the children to fight it out and tell us.
And so, you know, in our situation, all of us have to choose from competing options.
Right.
So why is that?
Well, I mean, we live in a world of scarcity. In other words, the means at hand to achieve our ends are always going to be scarce or are limited relative to our ends. I mean, we're the sort of creatures we can constantly think of the future and of better and better and better things, and there's really no limit to the ends that we can dream of or think about. And yet we have to labor to achieve our ends because they're not just going to happen. We can't just snap our fingers and make it happen. But we live in a world full of stuff. There's stuff all around us. And yet we have to rearrange and turn it into something that's an economic good or that is a suitable means to achieve the end that we imagine. And so that reality means that we have to choose, and every choice carries a cost. So that, you know, the first principle upon which all economics is built is there's no such thing as a free lunch,
mm-hmm.
and a good economist will not give up on that principle, whereas a poor one will compromise it readily.
I want to make a comment. I listened on Thursday afternoon to Dr. Yuri Maltsev give a... going to get another break now. So we'll come back right after the break, folks, and I'll continue that story in our interview with Dr. Paul Cleveland as we discuss understanding the basic principles of freedom. You're listening to Radio Free Market. This is Michael McKay. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and talking with Dr. Paul Cleveland and our special commentator, Ms. Zoe Russell. And I was just relating before the break the experience I had just the other day up at the University of Iowa when I heard Dr. Yuri Maltsev talking about this power of choice. And he said, you know, half an hour ago, I didn't know that I was going to want this bottle of water. And he said, half an hour ago, I decided, okay, I think I want this bottle of water. And every day, there are trillions and trillions of choices that are being made by individuals spontaneously, without planning, and on the cuff as we go along throughout our day. And he was using this as an illustration that this is one of the things that central planners just simply can never understand. Because a central planner might plan it such, okay, it's 3:30, nobody should be needing water by that particular time. And the very nature of a central planner is this lack of ability to know what the choices are potentially going to be for people throughout the economy. And as he makes this point of trillions and trillions of people are making these kinds of, trillions and trillions of choices are being made by people throughout an average given day. So would you say, Paul, that this insight of the power of choice is really at the center of this most significant knowledge about human action?
Oh, absolutely, Michael. And not just that, but then we begin to see also, coupled with that, why the economic profits and losses are so important. Mm-hmm. Because what that tells us, those are signals to people that in the marketplace. I mean, if a business is generating a profit, is economically profitable, then what people are saying is, do it again, do more of it. We really like that. You are creating value for us. And then on the other hand, if a business is suffering losses, then the market, the people in our in the economy are saying, don't do it again. And you know, because what the losses represent are destruction of wealth. Now, the one who's suffering the loss is the owner of the business taking the loss, and that's where it ought to be.
Right.
And so the very notion of bailing out businesses being too big to fail and that sort of thing, that's just really foolish.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if they're failing, they ought to fail.
Right. It is like any other organism.
Right. They ought to go out of existence, and somebody better suited could come in, take possession of the capital, and do a more effective job of producing a product with it that would be valued by the other participants in the marketplace.
You know, this bridges nicely to the next section I wanted to go into. So let's talk about information. And this will also help our listeners understand why political solutions to social problems are so very limited. Ultimately, Paul, you say that information, the information that we need only arises in the context of an ongoing, and I think the word ongoing here is extremely important, market. So what supplies the market that needed information?
Well, the very actions of people in trade, I think, is where the information is embedded, and it's in the, you know, the countless prices that we observe. Because, you know, for instance, we go into the marketplace, even in the grocery store, say, and we walk the aisles, and maybe we've already prepared a list of things we think we want. But then, of course, there'll be the grocery store will have certain things on sale, and you go, well, you know, this is a good time to buy this and these other things, because those will be useful to me, maybe not immediately, but at some point in time, and I can use that now. So these prices are the signals to us of when might be a good time to buy something, or when I might want to postpone.
And so prices give us the immediate feedback as to the wisdom and timeliness of a decision. And why is that a particular problem to politicians and other central planners of all stripes?
Well, I've noticed that most politicians simply don't like market prices and always want to choose a different price. You know, for example, if the price of gasoline rises, they don't want it to rise for some reason. But the fact that the price is rising is a signal, you know, either maybe gasoline is becoming more scarce, or maybe it's just becoming in greater demand. But it tells us to reevaluate our plans
mm-hmm.
about how much gasoline we would prefer to use or not use. And so whatever the market price is an important signal. And so when politicians come in and disrupt that signal, what they're doing is they're like jamming a radio signal that you can't pick it up, and so you're just getting noise.
Mm-hmm. And also I would add that they assume they're experts about something they really know little or nothing about.
Yeah. After all, in this healthcare thing, I mean, what do these people know about healthcare?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they don't know anything. What do they know about insurance? They know
mm-hmm.
nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So they have set themselves up as if they're the experts on everything, when actually they're likely experts on nothing.
So in the market, we consumers, we speak the language of and read the language of prices, but in the halls of power and control, they don't speak the language of prices. What language do they speak?
I think they speak the language of power and busybody meddling in the affairs of others. You know,
and also ignorance of their own ignorance.
Right, ignorance of their own ignorance, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. When they fail, I don't think we ever see them get humble.
No, and as a matter of fact, they're always very able to find someone else to blame.
Mm-hmm.
Typically for things they should take the blame for.
Mm-hmm. So they tend to seek more money and control, and
right.
This is, as Bob Higgs calls it, the ratchet effect.
Right, right.
Right.
And I think it was Rahm Emanuel in the as the election drew near and as when Barack Obama was elected, said, well, we can't allow a good crisis to go to waste. And really, that's the central theme of Robert Higgs' ratchet theory, is that what government will do to grow itself is to use a crisis and then to expand power, the government power and control. And even after the crisis is abated, while they might step back some, they'll never step back to where they were beforehand. And so what you'll have is just government growing step by step over time. I think it was H.L. Mencken that said, you know, the political class is always wanting to put in the minds of people fear about something or another, and that they'll create all sorts of hobgoblins out there that are just, even if they're mythical, even if they don't really exist, they want to keep the public in a sense of calamity so that they're seeking government to to address the problems that they face.
And then a side of politicians, there are those who are seeking privilege for themselves in self-seeking ways, as you put it, and that just further confuses the market.
Right, exactly. And there's a healthy dose of that. They typically exempt themselves from programs and policies that they enact. For example, they don't pay Social Security tax, and they're not on that system. They've exempted themselves from the health care bill. You know, so all in many ways, they've exempted themselves in numerous ways from having to deal with some of the things that they're imposing on others.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this from a different direction. Let's talk about this from the direction of fiscal policy. First, for new listeners who are just starting to learn these basics of economics, what does fiscal policy mean?
It's quite simple. It's, at root, it's nothing but government taxing and spending.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever policies they choose in terms of taxation and spending for, you know, over time in any particular year.
And this of course, has shifted significantly from the founding days of the American Republic.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Really, for the first, from, you know, the founding of the country up till around the turn of the 20th century, spending as a percentage of GDP by the federal government remained at less than 2% of GDP.
Mm.
So, as a matter of fact, you know, at the turn of the century, of the 20th century, total government spending at all levels, federal, state, and local combined, stood at less than 10%.
Mm. And today?
Well, we've seen that increase just slightly, I say. You know, well, what is it? The figure they throw out is that the federal government's what's spending about a quarter of every dollar. But if you go in and think about the effects of all their rules and regulations, it's really much higher than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then when we add in state and local governments, which have also increased in size and scope over the past 100 years. And it says it's the result of this mentality of shifting our focus and trying to look to government to solve the problems that we face, and really it's a poor institution for that.
Mm-hmm. And this is the trend that we see with Bastiat's comment of that government is that fiction whereby everyone tries to live off of everyone else.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's
correct. I actually wanted to use a quote that you have in your book from Thomas Jefferson that we can see this shift by looking at this quote. It's the quote that comes from his first inaugural address. He says, "A wise and frugal government shall restrain men from injuring one another, shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. This is the sum of good government." Yeah, I was looking at this particular chapter in your book on fiscal policy, and I thought to myself, gosh, we could use the rest of the show just, you know, briefly touching on this particular single chapter. And I would like to focus on one more section in this particular book in terms of a story that you mentioned about how in 1914, the move of the U.S. into World War One, and you specifically write that World War One broke out in Europe, and Wilson, despite his words to the contrary, began looking for a way to enter it. And in 1917, the U.S. entered the war, and Wilson maneuvered politically to establish a state corporate collectivism to manage the nation's resources for the effort. And tell us more about that particular.
Sure. You know, Wilson was an ardent progressive, and I think there, you know, he really, among all the past presidents, probably set us on the road towards government takeovers of more and more areas of our lives than perhaps any other except Roosevelt and then our current president, who seems to be pretty adept at all this too, of heading us in a particular direction that's not going to work out well.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Wilson did, I mean, you know, in terms of World War One, I think right from the outset, he, you know, it's a perfect example of seeing a crisis and making use of that crisis to consolidate federal government power and control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what the progressives sought to do. They wanted government to be more and more involved in people's lives and not leave individuals free. They tended to reject the natural law conceptions of the founders, and they wanted to rewrite the Constitution. They wanted to get rid of the Constitution, obfuscate it, in order to consolidate political power and control.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as I said, we don't have time to go through every section of your book, but there are a couple of things I would like to at least touch on. You mentioned in your book the importance of trade, transportation for trade. And our transportation policy, how it has evolved, has been a very interesting part of American history that I believe most Americans are fairly unfamiliar with. So we don't have time to dig into it in detail, but give us a brief overview of that, if you would.
Well, sure. You know, transportation's always been one of those issues. It's an obstacle to trade because we have to overcome the distance between between trading partners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to go to the grocery store, you got to get there, and so forth. So, transportation is you know, one of those important features. And if you look back over the course of human history, as we've made improvements in transportation. mentioned, the amount of trade has increased dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's an important area. Now, the government's involvement with transportation has been, you know, sporadic over time. One example I think I draw from in the book is actually from Burton Fulsom.
Mm-hmm.
I first read it in his book, The Myth of the Robber Barons, in a discussion of the transcontinental railroads.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense that they would do this. The way in which those railroads were largely built was with
government subsidies.
Government subsidies.
Right.
And I think I hear the music in the
background. Yeah. So, yes, we are going to break again, folks, and we will be back right after this break for our final segment with Dr. Paul Cleveland. And we will be discussing again the understanding the basic principles of freedom. So this is Michael McKay with Radio Free Market and Zoe Russell as well. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and I'm talking with Dr. Paul Cleveland. And, Paul, we were just talking about the transportation policy and the history of government interference with that. And there's a story about James Hill and his railroad that contrasts this story, this
right.
whole government intervention story, quite well. Could you bring that out a little bit?
Well, sure. Most of the transcontinentals were built, as we were speaking, as a result of the Railroad Act. Once again, this was a Republican Act that occurred, you know, around in the 1860s,
mm-hmm.
and was subsidizing these railroads.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out all of those went bankrupt
mm-hmm.
in time. And the reason they were is because the subsidies were based in terms of miles of track laid.
Right.
And so they used the cheapest possible materials. They didn't care about the route.
Most circuitous routes.
Yeah, in fact, they would lay lines off the main line if it were easy until they hit a ravine and then you just stop. So
uh-huh.
we had a line off the main line to nowhere. And, but they got land and money.
And by contrast, Mr. Hill was a private enterprise.
Right. The only one of the transcontinentals that was entirely private was James Hill's Great Northern from St. Paul, Minneapolis to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And he built his with his own money.
Mm-hmm.
And he never extended the line until there was a sufficient demand at the other end for him to do so.
Mm-hmm.
He chose to use the highest quality materials to build the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, he also purchased
the land from the Plains Indians, whereas the Transcontinental...
Correct.
Wasn't as liberal.
That's absolutely right. And so, you know, he was always in the railroad business, and he knew that his customers, you know, were important. That he would go into a town and say, "Look, we'll either succeed together or we'll fail together," and so it's important for us to be on the same page. If you will.
So, Paul, I want to jump ahead here while we still have a few minutes. You have a chapter that I think is very important. It's on welfare policy, and you start that chapter discussing the socialistic concept behind all welfare policies. Would you please discuss for us the nature of socialism and its spreading impact in our world today?
Sure. Once again, this goes back to this idea of collectivism that we can... somehow through throwing our all of our property into a common purse somehow be better off, and that's really a misnomer that doesn't work, and we're warned against doing such things in terms of traditional common wisdom, and yet, you know, that's been the direction things have gone in. And rather than promoting welfare, we actually get the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marx advocated the abolition of property rights altogether, you know,
right.
And he saw this as an institution as being the source of the problems that people faced.
And of course, it's just the reverse because, you know, property exists because of who it is that we are. I mean, we're physical creatures and we produce property in order to survive in this world. And property already exists. And so somebody's going to determine how to use it. Now,
okay, so I'm going to have to interrupt you right now, Paul.
Okay.
It's going to be the close of our show. I want to thank you very much for being with us. And please, everyone, please check out Paul's book, Unmasking the Sacred Lies by Dr. Paul Cleveland. And finally, Paul, I want to thank you for being with us today. And
thank
you. Very good. And this is Michael McKay and Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.